Welcome back, friends, to the Death with Dignity podcast, episode 8. My name is Andrew Flack, and I'll be your host. Today, we are joined by Dan Diaz, widower of Brittany Menard. We've referenced Brittany several times on this podcast. She was the spark that lit the fuse and catalyzed the legislative process in California to make medical aid in dying a choice for people with a terminal illness. Dan opens his heart and shares his love story with us and also explains why he still advocates for medical aid in dying today. We recognize Brittany's strength, courage, and resiliency, and also thank Dan for displaying those same traits and taking the time to join us for this episode. We hope you enjoy the story and appreciate your support.
Very good.
Yeah. And again, thank you for just taking the time to be here and sit down and talk with us. Do you still get a lot of requests and I guess media attention?
It depends on what's happening legislatively. So like this past year, we kind of reauthorized in California. And when we did that, then yes, there will be some journalists who want to. When this topic comes up, they typically want to hear from Brittany Menard's husband, sure. which that's something that I've always said that I don't have a name in this. No, people don't know who I am. People know who Brittany is, and I'm totally fine with that.
Sure.
And so yes, it'll be okay. Well, let's get a comment from Brittany Menard's husband. What would Brittany's thoughts be on this, or how does this the changes being made or whatever's going through legislatively, how does that match with Brittany's experience and what she had to endure? In California, for example, we removed the 15-day waiting period. There was no medical reason for that. There was no basis. There was no benefit to a patient to say, you now have to wait. You've qualified for this. Now you got to wait 15 days. Sure. And so in California, the biggest change is that we, instead of those 15 days, now it's 2 days that the person, they still have to, you know, two physicians independent of one another still have to agree the person is terminally ill with 6 months or less to live. That person has to be mentally competent. They make the request both verbally and in writing. There's the now 2-day waiting period. There are witnesses involved. I mean, all those safeguards are still there, and it's not an easy process to get through. But at least now, the most onerous one, which was basically saying, amongst terminally ill patients, they didn't refer to it as a waiting period. They referred to it as the 15-day suffering period, because literally that's what you're doing. You're wondering, am I going to survive this 15 days? And, you know, when you have cancer, it's not like the waiting period it's not that the cancer cells are waiting around. If anything, towards the end, those cancer cells are multiplying even faster. Or if somebody who has ALS, as an example, the deterioration of their muscles and what they are able to control, that's only getting worse, and it's not a linear thing. You have days where all of a sudden the drop off is significant. So very proud of what we were able to achieve in California this year. But yes, then along with that, there will be some renewed interest in, and you know, they'll talk about Brittany's story and they'll want a statement. It does still occur.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And those are all, I think, really good points. I gravitate towards what you said about some of these diseases and how I kind of refer to it as the slippery slope. And it seems like with some of these diseases, and when you're in a position like this, you feel, you know, you might be feeling good one day, and then all of a sudden, you might have a fever, things just start getting worse, then you're in the hospital, and then it's just downhill from there. And I try to be very cognizant of that, because I've been fortunate enough to where I've had been going down that slippery slope and been able to bounce back. But I know right. that there will be a day and moment where it's not, you know, I won't be able to bounce back. And it's just important with these diseases, how quickly you can just deteriorate. I mean, it's pretty incredible from some of the, you know, just personal experiences with people and being around the hospital and such. So I hear you when you say that 15 day suffering period. I mean, what is the point of that? It's silly. But we are here with Dan Diaz today. We kind of got started and had a little technical errors earlier, but I think we got that covered. So Dan, just tell us about yourself. Introduce yourself, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Yeah, fill us in. Why are you here? And tell us about yourself.
So born and raised in California, just outside of San Francisco. Actually, I am the son of immigrants. My first language happens to be Spanish. My parents were Cuban. They immigrated to this country, escaping the communist dictatorship of Fidel Castro back in 1962. I obviously, by the look of me, and since this is a podcast, but it's, and Brittany used to joke, it's like, yeah, you're one of the whitest guys. It's like, yeah, based off of appearance, but as far as, you know, the food and language and culture, for me, everything was always Spanish.
That's cool.
And so anyhow, grew up here in Northern California, went to school at UC Berkeley. So wasn't too far to get from where I grew up in Alameda to Berkeley. It's like 20 minutes away. And when I started, through my 20s and everything, and then, you know, I was already working in the corporate world, and was then dating. And at that time, the Match.com was the online app, and that's how I met Brittany. We met online. Brittany, at that point, she had just finished graduating from UC Berkeley. She was living in Oakland. I was living in Oakland, and we went out on our first date. That was in April of 2007. That just led to us more dating, becoming boyfriend and girlfriend, and then we were a couple. I kind of maybe jumped to
No, you're doing just fine.
That question, but yeah, that's why I have three brothers. We all live in Northern California. We're all pretty close. With the holidays coming up, we hang out at my parents' house.
Cool.
Which is where I mentioned, that's where I am right now. What used to be one of our bedrooms is now the computer room. So
sure. So let me ask about your folks, because that is, I feel like that story in itself could, I'm sure there's so much weight to it. And so it could be a whole discussion on its own. Can you touch base a little bit about their transition to America? And I mean, how, gutsy move and just incredible. I always kind of admire, you know, that type of story. I mean, it seems like they were able to come over and obviously, you know, have success here in America.
Yeah. So my mom's from a town called Cienfuegos, which is kind of on the southern part. She was 12 years old. She left Cuba with her older sister, and they were actually coming over, and they ended up in Boston or Cambridge, Massachusetts, because their older brother, my uncle, he was a student at MIT. Incredibly intelligent individual. And so for him, there was just the thinking that, you know, I needed to go to university in the U.S. You know, and nothing in Cuba would have been, you know, sufficient for him. So here he is. And but yes, once things get bad with Castro's power grab and what he ended up doing to that country, I mean, basically for 60 years has not been a stitch of progress in Cuba because of you know, his Castro's revolution. Anyhow, so if you could get out, you could, or you did, you would try. And so, yes, my mom got out. And then my dad, he grew up in Havana and he left Cuba. He was 17 years old. He had some relatives in Miami and was there. And then of all things, he joined the U.S. Army. Anyhow, he ended up, after being in the Army, ended up coming out to California. Once my mother's parents got out of Cuba, and that was just a couple years later. So that was like in 1964. They also ended up coming to California because they heard that they had some contacts. They heard that maybe there was a job for my grandfather, and they ended up out here. And then, you know, a few years later, my parents met here in the U.S. and got married. And then I have one older brother and two younger brothers. So, yes, it was just a matter. I guess it's just that immigrant story. You come.
Yeah.
You work hard and you figure that this is the land of opportunity. And, you know, little by little, you save your pennies enough to a down payment on a house and then try to save up for your kids' education and everything else. But so, yes,
that's fabulous.
In a nutshell, that's their story.
So. Yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of details to go with it. Thank you for sharing that piece. I just admire those people who are willing to take that risk. I moved to California. I had a job lined up, but I didn't really know many people. I didn't really know anybody. And that in itself was a gamble. So to think of being at a young age and going to a different country and starting up like that, very impressive. And thanks for sharing that. And I got to ask too, as a native Californian, have you explored much of the U.S.? Did you ever have any interest of moving anywhere else? Now that I'm here and kind of settled, it's like, whew, I don't know. I don't know if I could ever leave. It's a good place to be. I really enjoy California.
I do enjoy it. Let's see. As far as other places I lived, Brittany and I lived together down in SoCal. We were in San Diego and San Clemente for about a year. And I've spent a few summers in Miami, visiting, you know, relatives staying there. A friend had a condo on the beach, actually just random coincidence, but about a year ago, you remember that condo building in Surfside, Florida that collapsed?
Yes.
That's the building that I stay at. That's the place that the family friend lives there. So
no crazy. Kidding.
She wasn't there that night, just randomly.
Thank God. Yeah.
But yes, that's where I would go and spend any summer. So it's, you know, weird.
Coincidental. Yeah. Extremely right. Weird.
But so yeah, as far as living anywhere, when I worked for Quaker Oats, had to spend some time in Chicago because that was our headquarters. I enjoy the Midwest. One of my brothers lived in New York for 14 years. My older brother, so I would visit there quite a bit. But no, of all the places I've visited, I enjoy visiting, but I do like coming back home to California. So,
absolutely. Absolutely. Cool. And so you told us a little bit about Brittany and how you met. When you started dating Brittany, were you thinking in your head, like, wow, this is a girl, like, this is the woman I'm going to marry? I mean, did you know that pretty quickly? And,
you know,
did you feel that?
There was a bit of that. And for her, both her and I, we would talk. And once we got married, we would joke about this. We were together for 5 years. Then we got married. So it took us 5 years and we were broken up in between there a couple of times. So it was one of these that we knew that we loved each other, but it was at times, it was a question of timing.
Sure.
You know, she was going to grad school and she had plans and she had enrolled to get a degree in audiology. She wanted to work with children and be potentially a speech pathologist. And then from there, after going into that program, she just wasn't what she envisioned. So then she did get her master's in education. So she got her master's degree, teaching credentials, and she was going to be a teacher. Always, Brittany was like a lifelong student. She just absorbed knowledge and really would seek that and enjoyed being kind of in the classroom setting. I, on the other hand, I was glad to get my degree and then that was it. It's like, yeah, I'd rather just be in the regular working world. But so then Brittany was contemplating actually going to law school, and she got accepted some really, you know, top-notch places. But at that point is when her and I were thinking of, okay, well, we're engaged, and now as far as getting married, and what do we? And so she said, okay, she'll put off law school until a little bit later. And so, you know, we bought a home together, we bought our house together, we got married, and we were just kind of at that point of looking to start a family. So we got married in 2012, September of 2012. And in 2013, we were contemplating, okay, we have our home here, and maybe let's fill this home with a bunch of little people. And she started having these headaches, and things started kind of the signs of, you know, the she'd wake up in the middle of the night, start throwing up, and be unable to go back to sleep. And so things just weren't right during that parts of that year, 2013. And then it was towards the end of that year. It was actually New Year's Eve, so December 31st of 2013, where we ended up in the emergency room. They did a CT scan, and that was the first time that we discovered that brain tumor. So at a point where, yes, as newlyweds and looking to start a family and everything else, all of a sudden everything goes off the rails, and now we're dealing with you know, cancer being in our lives and navigating just the odyssey that is, you know, the doctor's appointments and the brain surgery that you had and all the treatment options and clinical trials that you're looking and researching. And so that's how things kind of progressed the way things unfolded. And I guess it's hard. That part is just, it's tough for me to even now think through and accept it. That was what was in the cards. It's like, how did any of that play out? It's just crazy to think that you have all these goals and thoughts and ideas about life and what you're kind of hoping or expecting. And then something like chronic disease comes and the universe says, nope, that's not the way things are going to go. You know, but along the way, those in total 7.5 years that I had with Brittany, the answer to your question, to kind of get back to it, was, did I know that Brittany was the one for me? Yeah, there was always this feeling that Brittany and I, we had this connection that even during the times when we were apart, we still relied on one another. She would call me and she would say, Dan, you're the only person I can talk to about certain things. And so we would, and I would ask her, I'm like, wait, you're seeing somebody else at this point. We were apart for a year, in 2010, 2009, somewhere around there. And she would still say, yeah, but there's just certain things that you're the only one that I can talk to about whatever these topics were. It was just a matter of us, timing wise, getting to that space where we recognize, look, I love you, you love me, that's all that matters. we're going to be together. And so then the excitement of the, you know, wedding proposal and buying a house and all that came about. So
yeah,
it was a very, you know, loving relationship that,
I mean, it just listening to you, describe and talk about it, it's very evident that yes, that there was a deep love there. And I appreciate you taking the risk to kind of be here with us and talk about the subject, because one of the questions I did was wondering was, is it hard? Is it difficult to be here and talk about this and to think about Brittany and to just think about what occurred? And it sounds like someday maybe it is. There's probably still pain there. And I don't know if that, I mean, you don't wonder like if it ever goes away, right? I'm sure there's maybe you feel like there's a piece of you that's gone, if you wanted to touch on that at all.
So they say that when you lose somebody or this, you know, grieving or it is a process, and it is that indeed. So yes, there are days that, still good days and bad days, but, you know, I celebrate the life that Brittany led. And I will say that because of her having the option of medical aid and dying, and because of just her personality, who she was, her determination to live on her own terms, and also to take back that little bit of control, so that she could have some say-so as to how her final few days might play out. Along with that personality trait that she had, it allowed us during those 10 months that, you know, Brittany was diagnosed with cancer basically on January 1st. She died November 1st. So it was 10 months to the day. And within that time, we were able to, I mean, you have these conversations that I never expected that you would have with a person, but you talk about everything. The love you have for one another, your concerns, your fears, your hopes for the time that you have left. So in that regard, we were able to have those meaningful conversations, because we talked about, well, what happens when somebody, let's say there's a car accident or just something that's immediate and they didn't get those opportunities. A conversation that Brittany and I had is like, which one's worse? And this is a strange topic, but it's like, which one would be worse? Because for me, the idea that if somebody just kind of disappears because of something that happens very acute, a car accident as an example, that idea that you didn't have that chance to have those moments that Brittany and I did get. However, the flip side is, yeah, but during those 10 months, there certainly is a lot of discomfort that she's experiencing and pain. And at times, the appropriate term is she's suffering. They're not able to control those seizures that she's experiencing. They're not able to keep that pain at the base of her skull from being, even though she's on some hefty doses of morphine. Well, Dilaudid is 4 times stronger than morphine. And so, you know, they're doing what they can, but in those moments when she wakes up and she's, you know, throwing up and it's, those are the ones that it's like, well, yeah, you don't want to relive those and you don't, you wish that those didn't occur. The thought of Brittany and when I'll sit and reflect on the time that we had together, the life that we were able to live, it's one of those where I still, and I think it is a decision that I still choose to smile about it, right? I as much as there's just the grief and the heartache, it still brings a smile to my face, knowing who she was, her personality, and the life that she lived, and the experiences that we shared with one another. It it's still something that is, as much as at times it's tough to talk about, it's still with an overwhelming sense of you know, of love, of admiration, of pride in what, in her starting this conversation. So that's, you know, the place in my heart where all of this sits as it pertains to Brittany. It's in that realm of, yeah, there is the grief, but it's all just this positive, you know, I guess the term is love for her. So
it's courageous, just sharing that and choosing to be happy and to reflect on that in a happy manner and hold on to those good times. That takes a lot of courage. I give you credit for being that strong. The one thing that, you know, being sick, that for me, that I have always been worried about was what was going to happen to the people that I leave behind. That's what I always grappled with. I know that where I'm going to be okay. I'm comfortable with the idea. I have accepted my path, but I worry about the people leaving behind. And I've learned, especially through this podcast and just talking with my family members, that they will be okay. It will be a difficult process. It's not something that's just going to change overnight. But I think in them, they're so strong. And then even just sitting here and hearing you talk and sharing that, that to me is inspiring and motivating. It gives me hope as well that there is, you know, a level of acceptance that can be reached. And I appreciate that. When Brittany was having these headaches, I mean, you never, I'm guessing neither of you ever would think like it's a brain tumor. And tell us about how that, when you discovered that on New Year's Eve, how did that hit you? What was that like? Was there a level of denial or just shock? I feel like you go, from my experiences, you kind of go through waves of different feelings and emotions.
Yeah. So during that year, 2013, she did seek out the, a few specialists actually, and she went to see them, that none of them ever ordered a CT scan. So they, in their words, they just figured, oh, she was having migraine headaches. And so they attributed it to that. And they're saying it's not uncommon for somebody who is, you know, in her age bracket that maybe, and oddly, one of them actually said, you know, just because of the way that hormones work and everything, that if she was to become pregnant, that those migraines, actually, it may help alleviate some of that. And so, like I said, we're at the point of looking to start a family, but they didn't do a CT scan. And so things were bad in the middle of that year, June, July, August. It kind of, those headaches and things went away. And then towards the end of the year, during the holidays, they were back. And so we attributed a lot of that. We were thinking, oh, this is maybe the stress of the holidays, her parents were in town, and just all the activity going to you know, decorating the house and everything else. But on that day that we were in wine country, and it was kind of a gift that Brittany and I had given to one another, that was our Christmas gift. Let's go away for New Year's. So we're in wine country, which is just an hour and a half north of where we live. So we drive up there, we check into the hotel. That first night was great. That was the 30th. And then on December 31st, we'd gone to lunch that day. And I could tell she was uncomfortable. We get back and she starts throwing up the lunch that we had just eaten, and it's just not stopping. She tried taking a warm bath. It didn't help. And she just feels terrible. I said, we have to go to the hospital. And to what you mentioned, when this physician then says, oh, well, I'm going to, we'll do a CT scan. Right there at that moment, I'm like, CT scan? Well, I mean, why would you need that? That there's nothing wrong with her brain. I mean, so immediately what you mentioned, that this idea of denial, I was just, even before they did that test. But I was like, yeah, okay, do whatever you got to do. It's not going to be anything there. You know, but then that physician shows me the images and he says, you know, there's something here, you need an MRI. And that news, it just hits you like a ton of bricks. I mean, you just, you're floored. You don't know what to do. You're denying that it's possible that, you know, the scan that I'm looking at. Actually, this maybe not for the podcast, but if I can share my screen with you and you can see the, you need to give me the ability to share my screen.
Oh, right,
right. Says that I'm just saying that's not able right now.
Let's see here.
But she, you know, she feels miserable. They have her hopped up on some meds to try to control that pain. Thanks, now I can do it.
Cool.
And so by the time that night, we have to transfer her from the hospital that we're at in Healdsburg, and we have to get her to one that's closer to our house. And after the MRI that they finally did a day or two later, that's the first time we discovered that. So wow. What I'm showing you now is an image of the tumor that is in Brittany's brain and, you know, the enormity of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then there's also just the idea that wasn't just denial on our part. There were certain physicians who they would see that and they're like, holy crap, I haven't seen a tumor that big before.
Wow.
So they were even surprised by what, you know, here is this 29-year-old with something that large. So it was to what you're mentioning, just the reaction is absolute one of shock. All these emotions mix into it. Anger, just mad at the universe. It's like, how the hell could any of this be occurring to her? Never was it, Brittany never had that idea of, oh, you know, why me? Or it, but I did a little bit of like, damn it, there are a lot of shitty people on this planet who do really bad things. It's like, give this thing to one of them, you know, because Brittany certainly doesn't deserve anything like this. Those were my thoughts. Those weren't necessarily Brittany's, but, anyhow, so yeah, that the trauma of seeing those scans for the first time, and then, you know, you quickly click into the thinking of, okay, well, how do we, what is our path forward and what treatment options are available and what can we do? And so for Brittany, the first step was brain surgery, and they, of that image that I showed you, they were only able to remove about 35% of that brain. Because there's just parts of the brain that you cannot send a scalpel. The person, you know, They will not wake up, or they just won't be themselves anymore. Mm-hmm. So after that surgery, they let Brittany, though, know that she likely had 3 to 5 years to live. And, you know, as I mentioned, when she's 29 years old, that still sounds like that's not nearly enough time. Unfortunately, at the first follow-up MRI, just 2 months after her surgery was on January 10th. So this would have been like in March, late March, early April. The first follow-up MRI showed that the tumor had changed. It was now growing aggressively. It changed grades, indicative of a glioblastoma multiforme. So that's the most aggressive type of brain cancer. And that's when they told Brittany, you got 6 months. And so it was at that point that Brittany, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but it was at that point that Brittany said, okay, we need to look into moving to Oregon.
Sure.
Because she, we had already, Brittany had, again, her quest for knowledge, for data, for information. She had been researching, how does her end come about? A simple search on the internet will reveal what a person might experience as they're dying from a brain tumor like that. But we also had the firsthand experience that both Brittany and I, we each had a friend whose parent died of brain tumor, one of a GBM stage four, the other was a stage three at that time. But and so Brittany knew what was in store for her. The likelihood that as a tumor grows, puts pressure on the optic nerve that she goes blind. That happened with our friend's parents. The possibility, the mood changes. I mean, just personality changes where one moment you're fine and the next you're just very angry and aggressive and even violent. That part never occurred with her, or it didn't get to that point. The seizures, she was already experiencing those. The likelihood that she suffers a stroke, and then due to the lack of oxygen during the stroke, that she'd end up partially or completely paralyzed. You know, just looking at the list of things that she would have to endure, but then also those are some of those horrific symptoms are what our friend's parents actually experienced as they were dying. Brittany said, hell no, I will not die like that. You know, I prefer to be able to look around the room and say, I love you, and then experience a gentle dying process. And that's the whole thing with Brittany's story and what we alluded to earlier, Andrew, that this idea that talking about death and dying, oh, it's a hard topic. It's like, well, but Brittany's story really, if people think through it, her story really isn't about death and dying. It's really about life and living. Because what Brittany was doing by making that decision that we would move to Oregon so that she could apply for medical aid in dying, or their death with dignity law, that's what it's called in Oregon, was simply taking control of the amount of life that she had left. You know, death is inevitable. It is just a part of life and living. So in that sense, there's nothing really all that significant about it. It will happen to each and every one of us at some point. But the manner in which that death comes about, that is what you know, Brittany, the conversations that we had, she was simply saying, you only get to do this once. And the idea of experiencing a good dying process, that's simply the extension of having lived a good life. So for her, she was not going to allow the cancer to be in the driver's seat. And basically you're just rolling the dice and saying, okay, how much suffering am I going to have to endure? What's the end going to be like? And so that part of that just speaks to her personality, her determination, a very loving and caring person, but also a no nonsense person. She, you know, the idea of suffering and in her words, suffering needlessly. For what?
Right.
Her death is coming. Death is inevitable. That brain tumor is ending her life. But the idea that she has to suffer through the worsening seizures, more pain, potentially being blind, paralyzed, stuck in bed with tubes coming out of her, obviously, you know, her body's still draining stuff. And she said, she would say, Dan, you imagine that? I'd be in bed as a suffering mass. I'd be able to hear you, but I'm not able to potentially respond because either by a stroke, suffering a stroke, you lose the ability to communicate as well. She's like, I wouldn't be able to respond or say anything to you. You're not able to, you know, move her or get her out of bed or anything and then have to endure all that and then die. Brittany says, no, that doesn't seem right, at least not for her. And here's the thing, I just want to emphasize this. The strength of this legislation or this program is that It's an option that if a person determines that, you know, their suffering may get to a point where modern medicine is not able to keep them comfortable, then they can apply for, qualify, and have this medication. And then they get to decide whether they end up needing to use it or not. The hope for Brittany was that she would not need to use it. The hope for Brittany was that, you know, hospice, palliative care, which, by the way, are wonderful fields of medicine that people should also not be afraid to research and ask questions about. But if hospice and palliative care was not enough in her case, that, okay, she could utilize this medication. So, and then the flip side, though, for an individual who, let's say, for maybe religious reasons, they're like, no, 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 I want to do everything I possibly can to live as long as possible. So they do want the artificial hydration and hooked up to a ventilator or whatever it is. Well, then that person's wishes needs also to be honored. And then that person should be able to have the dying process that they might want. But I think when people are honest and can have a conversation about this, I think most people, they do have certain limits, and they'll say, you know what, I'm willing to tolerate these types of treatments, but I certainly am not going to take this to the extreme. And if I find myself in Brittany's predicament where, you know, it gets to a point where every day is only worse than the day before, and things are, you know, the trajectory is definitely going downhill quick, that they too would want to know that they have this option for themselves. So that's, you know, that was Brittany's thinking. And I think I kind of expanded way beyond just your question of what did we do with that initial prognosis or diagnosis.
So this is just me. Yeah, very powerful stuff, Dan. I just appreciate how open you are willing to be and willing to take that risk. And it's this is wonderful. Just the information and the insight, and that you're willing to share your heart with us like this. Sure. Brittany was obviously very inquisitive, seeking knowledge, as you mentioned. I'm guessing that she managed to find information about this law in Oregon. And could you maybe just kind of talk about how she discovered this and what the decisions were behind that move?
That was interesting because Brittany, when she was at UC Berkeley, it was a topic that one of her professors had included in one of her classes. So I didn't know anything about medical aid in dying. At that point, there were only 4 states that allowed a terminally ill individual this option. Oregon being the one that had been the first. So at that point, it was Oregon, Washington, Vermont, and Montana. And so because of that class that she had taken as an undergrad, when we discovered that tumor, this is even before we went into surgery. We discovered the tumor January 1st. Brittany had surgery January 10th. Within that time, I think it was by like the 3rd or the 4th, she was on her phone doing research in the hospital still, in the intensive care unit, researching brain tumors. And at that point, it was a grade 2 astrocytoma glioma. So that's the lower grade that we're all focused on. But along the way, then Medical Aid in Dying, or Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, she clicked on that. She said, Dan, you know, this. Way back in college, I was an EMT, I was a lifeguard. So for me, I knew terms like, no, well, there's palliative care, and then at end of life, there's hospice care. And she's like, no, this is different. So after reading up on it, I recognized and saw what it is and thought, okay, so this takes it in a sense a step further, where this allows the patient to be in control. There wasn't really any hesitation, though, in my head about this, because the only thing Brittany is pursuing, and this is something that I've had journalists ask me the question, well, were you supportive of that? And so I pause and I'm like, well, define that. What are you saying? Am I supportive of Brittany having the option if things get bad that she doesn't have to suffer? Yeah, of course. Am I supportive that she may end up having to utilize this? Again, the answer is unequivocally yes, because who wants to see their loved one suffer horrifically only to still die? But at that point, it was just the idea that she found or was sharing with me, look, there is this option in Oregon, and if things get bad, we may have to move up there. because this is even before surgery, I'm thinking, Brittany, hold on, pump the brakes, I got you. But I mean, we haven't even done your schedule for surgery within the week. So let's do that. And then we'll get to the steps down the road. The only thing Brittany was doing, and it was only afterwards, when her diagnosis got really bad, that I recognized that she was just contemplating. Of course, there's the best case scenario where the things improve and she gets better, and that's the hope. But she was just taking into account, well, what's the worst case scenario? That things don't get better, and she ends up, you know, having to truly face death, as that's the trajectory of the disease. And so she was just taking stock as to if that worst case scenario plays out, what would she want to do? So there wasn't much. For me, I was also able to process it from the standpoint of, and this is what I challenge people to do, put yourself in her shoes. Because then I recognized, wait, if it was me, if I was the one who's in that hospital bed, staring up at that monitor, looking at that the size of that brain tumor that I just shared with you, then I'd be saying the same thing. I don't want to die. There's nothing about me that is looking for my life to end. I want to live. But I'm facing that thing that's up on that screen. Okay, if things get bad, then at least I want to know that I have a little bit of control over how things might play out. So that really just, when I challenge people and I, you know, ask them to do so, put yourself in her shoes and then recognize that, yeah, I'd probably be making the same decisions. I want to know I have this option. Nothing about it that I have to use it, but I know that I have it. I'll sign on with that. So.
Absolutely. And could you, again, I want to be mindful of your time.
No, we're good.
Could you tell us about, I guess, how Brittany ended up deciding that Oregon would be the best place for her to go, and maybe expanding on how she decided to make that decision to use that medication, what got to that point? That's something for me personally, I grapple with, is how do you know when yeah. to, if you're in that position, how do you know? Because like you said, the hope is, you know, for me, I just, when it's my time, I just want to go to sleep and that's that. You know, I don't want to use this medication, but if I need to, I will. And I've got my own kind of ideas as to what that would look like. But just wondering, you know, if you wouldn't mind sharing about how Brittany was able to kind of come to those decisions and make those choices.
Yeah. So the idea to move to Oregon was not an easy one. We had to, she had to find a new medical team up there. She had to find a house for us to rent on Craigslist. Imagine having to do that.
Yeah. Daunting tasks. I mean, the medical piece in itself is, I mean, that's in itself terrifying to try and do, but sorry, Right. Continue.
And so we pack up half of our house into a U-Haul say goodbye to our friends and family, and we drive 600 miles north just so that she'll have this option, which is why Brittany spoke up. She just felt it was a huge injustice that anybody would have to leave their home after being told you have 6 months to live. And the first thing you need to contemplate is, how's my dying process going to go? Okay, that doesn't sound good. So in order to have all end of life options available to me, I now have to leave my home and move to another state. So that was her reason for becoming this, you know, sharing her voice and trying to advocate for changes across the country, starting with California. That was, you know, her intent. But so I mentioned previously, there was only 4 states available at that time. We're now up to 11 states. So, you know, her voice certainly has made a difference, and I continue the promise I made to her. To, I've been to 18 different state capitals, and I speak with legislators to, you know, do what I can, share Brittany's story, and emphasize that terminally ill individuals in their own states, these legislator states, they shouldn't have to leave like we did. So her story still resonates. It's a very effective in that regard. But so that decision to leave and move to Oregon was, it, that's really the time that both Brittany and I, it's like, well, that's the time we wanted back. Nobody likes to, I mean, just think of when you're in college even, or you're having to move, nobody likes to move. You pack up all your stuff, you realize how much junk you've accumulated, and you got to clean and then find the new place and who's the landlord and what's the contract and all this. I mean, mind you, we have a home already in California. We figured we're done with that kind of stuff. Well, now we find this other house that we try to make feel like a home, and that's going to be where we live. And so all that was just a terrible disruption to what should have been just more family time. But once we got up there, that's when Brittany applied for, qualified for, and was finally granted that prescription. I think I mentioned, I don't know if it was in the last report, before we kind of did the reset, but you know, I just want to share that the process involved the two physicians, independent of one another, had to agree that she's terminally ill with 6 months or less to live. She has to go through this entire process. They check, you know, that she's mentally competent, and the witnesses, and the strongest safeguard is that the patient has to be able to consume that medication on her own. So this is nothing that is done to a patient. This is nothing. This is the opponents to this. They love using inappropriate terms because their attempt is just to scare people. Their campaign is based on fear. So they'll use terms like, oh, suicide or euthanasia. It's like, no. Euthanasia is the act by which a third party administers something to a patient that causes their death. Euthanasia is illegal in all 50 states. Overseas, it's done. There's places and clinics that'll do it. There's still a process to qualify, where the doctor actually administers something. But in the program here, what Brittany was advocating for and what I continue to advocate for, the patient is the one in control. They have to be able to consume, in her case, what was a sleeping medicine. So once we got to Oregon, it truly was just a matter of where she is living the best life that she possibly can. For her, being outdoors is what she loved the most. So we took a trip to Olympic National Park, Hood River. Brittany and I had taken the trip to Yellowstone. And we did the things that mattered to her. Now, in the meantime, we're also researching still every clinical trial that offers any glimmer of hope and all these alternative treatments. So we have the time, the ability to do all of that. that. Unfortunately, with the size of the tumor, and it's so frustrating that the response that we would get, they would see that and say, oh no, that's way outside of the protocol of this clinical trial. So they won't even accept you into the trial. And to a patient where you're like, look, I'm willing to give it a shot anyways. Let me sign on. But I understand these clinical trials, you know, they have certain parameters and they get it down to the DNA, what chromosome deletions a patient may or may not have in their DNA, which will tell them if they're going to be, if they will react better or worse to whatever the treatment is. So the advances of modern medicine, truly just wondrous. I'm in shock and so surprised at to the degree with which these physicians can really fine tune certain things. But when you're the patient and you're sitting there thinking, well, maybe this would help me out, so just let me be a part of the trial anyhow. And they're saying, no, you know, the funding that they get and the number of patients and the control group versus the this. Again, I get it, but that it was just frustrating time and again to receive that rejection notice saying, nope, you don't qualify. You don't meet what we're looking for. You can't be included in this trial. So we focus then on, you know, doing the things that are important to Brittany. And you know, in the middle of the night when she can't sleep, that's where those conversations that Brittany and I would have about her hopes, her fears, how she see things going. And, you were able to say those important things to one another and just talk about everything. I mean, I have to take a leave of absence for work. So for me, and I try to keep this from her, but just the financial stresses of this.
Sure.
My pay gets docked. I'm all of a sudden only making like 2/3 of what my normal. And I'm concerned like, shit, am I going to lose my healthcare coverage? Because if insurance goes away, it's like, well, how do we even maintain this? And so there's that aspect of it. And so just all the stress and everything. So unfortunately, as that year progressed, the symptoms that Brittany's experiencing, they are just getting worse. That tumor, Brittany is making decisions about kind of her path forward based off of, most importantly, how she's feeling. There are days where she would wake up and she could kind of predict. She'd say, Dan, keep an eye out on me today because I think I might have a seizure. And there was a lot of times where she was right. There were other days she would wake up and just the way she was feeling, she would say, you know, on days like this, I can tell that I have cancer. On days like this, I can tell that I am dying. And you know, some of those days we'd still go for a little hike outside. We'd go to her favorite sushi place. On other days, if she's had a seizure, then we would just stay hunkered down on the couch. And we never were big fans of, we didn't watch a lot of television, but all of a sudden we're watching certain things on Netflix or HBO. We watched Game of Thrones. That was unique for us. It's like, oh, so we got into that. Brittany got into that. So we would watch that. I think it was only through season 2 or 3 of Game of Thrones. So the tumor, the cancer is progressing, and Brittany was trying to live to celebrate 2 dates in particular. One was our wedding anniversary. So that's September 29th. So for her to make it to the end of September was her dealing with a lot of discomfort and worsening symptoms. The second event was my birthday, which is at the end of October. And so she, same, but you know, for her to get through the month of October, those seizures are becoming more frequent, more severe. She would warm up this like beanbag pill in the microwave and put it, she would sleep with it. And that would help kind of alleviate the pressure that she felt at the base of her skull. And so when the media latched onto her story, that was October 5th. So it was about three and a half weeks before Brittany died. Brittany had made this video. Basically, the purpose for the video was to try to help affect change legislatively. And so the individual that had put the video together, they then approached Compassion and Choices. And that's the organization who they hosted it on their website. And they got some, because they do, and I continue to work alongside Compassion and Choices, but they have their, you know, their media director, national campaign director, and all these other wonderful individuals. And so he brought some attention to it. And so People Magazine called Brittany. They interviewed her for a story that they were going to put online. And so on the day that CNC put the video on their website, the People Magazine article online ran. And I think it was like 9 a.m. West Coast time. I'm sorry, 6 a.m. West Coast time, 9 a.m. on the East Coast. Our phones just start blowing up. We're still asleep. And people, friends that we know that live on the East Coast are sending us messages saying, you know, I'm looking at Brittany's picture. It's up on my television screen. So, you know, CNN, ABC, NBC, CBS, everywhere. And so that brought all this attention to Brittany's story. And so for those, Brittany said that for 2 weeks, she says, we'll allow the media to, you know, be a part of our world. But then she said, after that, we're back to family time. Because she just didn't know how much energy she would have or the ability to give interviews. So really during that time, there was only a couple of interviews that Brittany actually did. She wasn't feeling that great. The majority of the stories that were being run came from, they were just taking snippets off of the video that Brittany had made. And then maybe they'd interview her or me or somebody from Compassion Choices by phone. And so that, you know, that was her effort to, as they say, you know, be the change that you want to see. So she's like, all right, well, try. And so for those 2 weeks, she put herself out there. In the meantime, she did make a second video, which was then released. And, you know, skipping some of Brittany was rather upset when they released that. And they were saying, oh, well, Brittany Menard, she's changed her mind. And this and the other, well, I'm mixing a bunch of things in here, but I'll just make this point. The reason that Brittany chose November 1st, and she said this publicly, and so I'm glad to clarify this with your listeners, is that November 1st was simply a date for Brittany to try to live to. It was a goal. See if I can live to or beyond this date. The reason she chose it is because it allowed us to celebrate our wedding anniversary, my birthday. But in no way was that saying, oh, November 1st, you know, doesn't matter how I'm feeling, that's the date. It was not. For her, though, it was a way to say, well, let me see if you know, if I can make it to November 1st, because she was feeling really bad. And you know, the symptoms that she was suffering, like I said, for her to make it through September, for her to make it through October, those were not easy months.
Yeah.
But the media, they latched onto it and made it sound like, oh, this person has made up their mind that on this date they're going to die. Now, in the end, that did end up being the day that that morning we went for a small short hike. With the dogs, with her friends. And when we got back, Brittany had had a seizure that morning. And when we got back, she said, you know, Dan, it's just my time. because what she was risking, and this is something, Andrew, that you'd mentioned, for her, the fact that that tumor, it's affecting, you know, the central processing unit, the main computer, it's in her brain. For her, what she's risking is that if she does suffer a stroke, if she does become partially paralyzed, if she's unable to consume that medication on her own, well, then in her case, she'd be stuck dying exactly the way that she was trying to avoid. Mm-hmm. And so that question of, well, when do you know? Like, when can you be certain that that it's, you know, the appropriate time? Brittany's answer to that is that I guess maybe her system, her body was sending her, you know, certain signals, and she's making what I mentioned before, that the decisions based off of how she's feeling. But every time we get a scan, another scan, MRI, and we see the progression, the physicians are able to point out and say, well, you've been feeling like the weakness that you were having in one of, I think it was her left leg, her ankle, that's because of, and they could actually point and say, this part of the brain here being impacted. Mm-hmm. And some of those symptoms that you've been feeling, well, that was probably caused by what we're seeing over here on this side, which seems to be really, you know, lighting up now. So this for her was a very methodical process of her thinking through. But because of the worsening symptoms for the last few weeks, on the day that she decided that, you know, you're no longer living through those days, you're only suffering through them. I think that's when a person is more able to say, huh, okay, I kind of see how things are going. And now it's not such a mystery as to when do you know it's time. She, I think, was picking up on those cues that her body was sending to her, that she is, and it's strange to say, but she is kind of in an active dying process, that, you know, things kind of turn a corner. On that day, on November 1st, within 5 minutes of taking that medication, Brittany fell asleep. And within 30 minutes, then her breathing slowed to the point where she passed away. So whenever I've talked with individuals and I've asked them, given your druthers, how would you want your death to go? Let's say you don't die at 29, flip those numbers around, you live to be 92, however old you are. Most people answer, well, I'd want to die in my sleep. Just, you never wake up. You don't even know it occurred. You know, it's a shock to whoever might find you the next day, but that's it. As far as you're concerned, like, that's it. They punched my clock, I'm checked out.
Yep.
Right? That is the answer that I repeatedly hear time and again. It's like, yeah, you die in your sleep. And then I guess I have to remind them, because it doesn't really click. I'm like, well, that's what Brittany got. She was able to die in her sleep. The only thing in her case, obviously, she had to go through, you know, this extraordinary odyssey of leaving home and everything else. But at the end of the day, for Brittany, she got to experience that gentle dying process that anybody would prefer or would want to, you know, sign on for if they had their druthers, as I mentioned. So that's why when I mentioned earlier that this really isn't about so much about death and dying, it's more about life and living and this crazy thing, that this roller coaster that we're all on. You know, focus on that, emphasize that in our day-to-day routine, our relationships with one another. And for her, she was just taking taking back that little bit of control from the tumor, so that her dying process would be in accord with what she wanted to experience. In the end, Brittany didn't die. And again, this would be the way that she categorized it. She didn't die as a victim to cancer. She died in the same way that she lived her life, with grace and determination and love. So in that regard, it just became a lot less scary, this idea of, you know, death and the inevitable. So I guess I think I answered maybe a few of the other questions.
You nailed it, Dan. Thank you. I'd like to just circle back and kind of emphasize too, one of the pieces that I've learned throughout this experience is that having that option, you know, in Brittany's case, or someone who's sick like this, to be able to use that type of medication, it does provide so much in that not a lot of people, when they do die and check out, are with, you know, or have the opportunity to be with the people who they care the most about in the world, and to be with them as you transition. And having that option versus something like you had mentioned earlier, you know, a sudden tragic loss. I mean, which is better? You know, I guess everyone could kind of come up with their own answer and think on that one. But I think most empowering about this situation is that, yes, I will be able to be with those people. And it sounds like Brittany had that opportunity too. And I think that's a really beautiful thing. And I love as well how you talk about how this is more about life and living. Let's focus on that piece. We all will experience the death part, but right now this is what's so important, and appreciating the time that we have. So just really tremendous stuff, very powerful stuff. I wish I had more to offer and say, but I'm going to need some time to reflect on this one. Really appreciate all that insight, and just again, you sharing your heart with us and telling us about Brittany, who was no doubt just a tremendous individual. Hasban, do you have any questions or comments? Usually Hasban's got a couple gems, if you don't mind.
No, that's fine. I have a little bit of time before the next thing. I sent him a text a little earlier, so it's okay.
Excellent.
I really enjoyed the conversation, by the way. Thanks for going so deep. I guess I just had one question real quick. You mentioned like legislative, political, and public-facing effort, and you really seem to understand what it means to be an advocate at this moment. I guess I just wanted to ask what you've learned from being like an advocate, and if there's any advice you have for us even.
The advocacy thing has been, it's interesting, early on, showing up to a state house, speaking with an elected official, a senator, assembly member, I felt really intimidated by that. It's like, this is, you know, the senator, and here I am in Rome, in the halls of Sacramento, the capital, and I'm supposed to somehow convince them that they should support this legislation. Over time now, I guess, I don't know, I think I'm somewhere north of 850 legislators that I've spoken to over these years.
Wow.
Now it's like, no, these are people, these are human beings just like you and me. And at times, and by the way, I know in today's politically charged climate, there still are some good, solid politicians, legislators, that they are there to try to improve the lives of their constituents. That's the role of government. There are some who it's just ego and they don't care to actually legislate. They just want to be on TV. So I've run across the whole gamut. The making that personal connection, when I've spoken with legislators, doesn't matter if they're Democrat, progressive, Republican, conservative, red state, blue state, if they have had the experience themselves with a loved one of a potentially having experienced a bad death experience, a hard dying process with a loved one, they're on board. They know exactly where we're coming from then. For ones who have not experienced this, then I get into the whole, okay, let's talk about a topic that they're right away going to shy away from. They don't want to talk about death. Forget about medically dying, just the idea of death. A lot of people are not comfortable talking about that. So that makes like that, that's the challenge, is to find, you have to find a person where they are, meet them where they are, and try to get through to them, share that this should be something that's made available to terminally ill individuals. My biggest opponent, doesn't matter what state I've been to, has always been the Catholic Church. Support for medical aid in dying nationwide is 72%. Actually, I think it's a little bit higher now, the most recent polling. Wow. Support amongst Catholics is 70%. So the church leadership, and that's fine, they can be opposed to this. They want to take the position that we're opposed to this as an institution. That's fine. The people sitting in the pews, they agree with Britain. They recognize that this is not political issue. This is not a religious issue. This is a medical issue concerning, how much a person has to suffer at end of life. So, I say that I grew up as a Catholic. I went to Catholic school. I was an altar boy, the whole nine yards. The bishop here of the Oakland Diocese presented me with an Ad Altare Dei Award when I was 18, 19. That's an award for service in your Catholic community. I think I was 16 years old. So, well-informed as far as the Catholic doctrine or the church doctrine. But I've had plenty of conversations with priests who they admit that, in a sense, they kind of do this anyways behind closed doors. That when a patient is suffering, that they just keep increasing the morphine, even though they know that that's going to bring about that person's death. Mm-hmm. So I find it quite hypocritical that they feel empowered that it's like, no, we will control when potentially Brittany dies after she's suffered through a stroke, after she's paralyzed. Okay, we've now determined she's suffered enough. So we'll give enough morphine where now maybe this evening she might pass away. Oh, and look and behold, that evening comes and goes. And yeah, that's when she died. That's a direct result of the medications that they were giving her. And that narrative, by the way, I'm not making that up. I also speak at palliative care conferences. I work with physicians regularly, and that's the way that things go. So it is hypocritical that the Catholic Church would essentially recognize, and I've had literally nuns. There were these two in Boston when I testified, who they were nurses, and they were saying that we are very merciful in our hospital. We are very merciful. I was pressing her for, I wanted more information. The other one pulled her away, recognizing that politically that would not be a good thing for them to expand upon in front of me. That essentially they feel that they can be the ones to they will be the angels of mercy, and then make sure that a person doesn't suffer. Whereas Brittany's response to that is like, hey, you know what? I will take that immense responsibility. I'll take that upon myself. You guys don't even have to worry about considering when you think I might be suffering enough. I'll be the one to determine that for myself. So the idea that an institution like the church would say, no, you can't do this. We can do it in a sense to you, by giving you more morphine when we think the time is right, but we don't think that you should have that ability to make that decision for yourself. That again I have yet to find or have a discussion with anyone who takes that position. It does not stand up to a debate with Brittany or, you know, by proxy.
I agree. I just had one more question I wanted to ask you. You mentioned financial stress and how you kept that from Brittany. Watching Andrew go through what he's going through, I think about this a lot, is that someone has to deal with a terminal diagnosis, which is the most stressful thing in the world, while dealing with the stress of dealing with the finances. In your case, you had logistics involved of moving, and that part of the story really stuck out to me. I never thought about it too much until you like explained it. Like, you just bought a house, you have to move, you had to leave work as well. I don't know if you have advice for people or just any thoughts on that whole financial stress of having a terminal
that
disease
part,
while dealing with the disease, I guess.
I mean, that just speaks to kind of a broader issue that the ability for a citizen of this country, and this is where, again, I'm not trying to take sides on this, but this comes from the palliative conferences that I speak at. We spend more on healthcare in this country than, like, on a per capita basis than the next two or three combined. So we spend more on end of healthcare, and yet our results aren't what you would expect. We're not the tops when it comes to even mortality, women's mortality as it pertains to childbirth, end of life care, and there's a whole bunch of factors or a whole bunch of different categories where it shows that for the money that we spend, we are not the most effective. And so it does kind of beg the question that with the size and the wealth of this country, we should have a better healthcare system so that it isn't this question that so many people face of, do I fill this prescription and have to pay out of pocket for, pick the disease, diabetes, cancer, whatever it happens to be, or do I simply, of the pills that I have left remaining, I just cut those in half and I take less of these because I have to pay rent or I have to buy groceries to put food on the table. So those decisions are ones that, it shouldn't be that way, that people are having to choose between those two. For us, it was not easy. And yet I recognize that people are in far worse predicament where, I had to take a leave of absence from work, and I had to work through all of that with my employer, even though they were cutting my salary, that the hope said, okay, but I get to keep my health care, and we got to figure out a way to pay the mortgage on the house that we have in California. Oh, and we're also paying rent and utilities and everything else on this house that we're renting up in Oregon. So, if I can see real quickly how a person is faced with these financial challenges and you're, facing bankruptcy and everything else. So that, unfortunately, it's a great question. I don't have an answer for you. Other than I would hope these, maybe as a society, we can all come to an agreement of there should be a level of healthcare that keeps takes care of us without people having to contemplate financial ruin. Because there are many cases where it's not a terminal case like Brittany's. It was just whatever acute illness or something that comes up that person will indeed survive, but in the meantime, they lost their place to live. They no longer have transportation. So yeah, it was extremely stressful. And I did everything I could so that Brittany wouldn't have to add that to her plate or even think about that. So I would do all that paperwork and stuff in the middle of the night. yeah, it's it that 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 is an issue that needs to be addressed and solved.
For sure.
Yeah, it's thank you. That's something I learned real quick is not only, you know, and basically cancer or a terminal disease is expensive. It's not cheap, you know, and not only am I basically dying from this disease, but you slowly go broke doing it. And you think based, you know, here in America, and again, another discussion for another day, probably another podcast itself, but is you'd think that we'd be able to kind of come up with better ways of going about it to support some of these people. But Dan, I did want to end on a more of like a positive note. And again, thank you so much for just sharing so much with us about Brittany and your experiences. And I would like, if you don't mind, could you share with us one of your favorite memories of Brittany, whether it be from when you first met her or towards the end of your time together, just something that sticks out in your mind that maybe kind of sums up who she was as a person and how you kind of valued her in that relationship. I'm sure there's lots to pick from as well.
Yeah, so. I was going to say from the days that we were dating, just our initial, we took a trip to New York together. We really had a good time. That was just a great vacation. We were in Manhattan for 5 days and just the dinners out, the things that we did during the day, taking just bike rides and doing touristy stuff, but then not touristy stuff as well. That one sticks out, but I guess if I was to pick a date that may seem somewhat obvious, but we really had a good time on our wedding day, which I know a lot of people, when they look back on their wedding day, it's like, oh geez, it just went by so quick. It's just like they didn't even remember, you know. That's but for us, it was this conscious thing, and it was the advice that I'd gotten from a coworker actually a couple of days before, who said, you know what, just on occasion, every so often, pull her aside and just even say, look, today's our wedding day. Look, you know, just take in what's happening around us. And we did that. So leading up to the ceremony and then the ceremony and then afterwards with the pictures and all that, we would just take these moments to acknowledge that, look at what today is and what's happening around us and all of these friends that are here and our family and the good times, that feeling of being loved and supported amongst her and I, one another, but then also the broader group that was there. It was like 100 people in total, so it wasn't a huge wedding or anything. So that is certainly a day that sticks out. And then obviously the benefit of having all the photographs that you can then relive it and truly recall, these are the emotions that we were feeling, and they were captured in all of those pictures. So our wedding day is certainly one that, for me, and the feedback we got from our friends, where they were saying, no, your wedding was actually a lot of fun. They really enjoyed it. Because we've all been to those weddings where you're like, kind of, you know, the DJ, dancing was that, the food was that. But, and maybe because ours wasn't that big, I mean, I guess 100, it's by some standards large, but in others not a huge group. We did really enjoy everybody's presence, everybody who was there, and it was a meaningful thing. And they the guests did also have a really good time. So
beautiful. That's beautiful stuff. Absolutely. And I think you sharing those kind of speaks to what I feel is almost like an overarching theme to this discussion, or something I really took away, is just that this doesn't have to be just on the death and dying piece, that this was an opportunity, and you had an opportunity with Brittany to focus more on life and living And that's something I'm really going to try to hold on to as we move forward, that it's a chance to really just be present and enjoy the time that we have here.
Andrew, what state are you in now?
I'm here in California. We live in Oceanside, actually. So we're we're right around that San Clemente area.
Oceanside. Brittany lived in Oceanside.
Really?
With me. Yeah, she her driver's license. I was going to just look up. She lived in Oceanside. I have her old ID, and I think it's her Oceanside address. So I was going to see,
if you know
where it is. We enjoyed that. When she lived there and I'd go down and visit.
It's a hidden gem. Yeah, I'm sure if you came down here, anytime soon, it has changed tremendously. Even just in the short, 7 years I've been here, really a different area and a lot of growth, but it's a beautiful place to be and just feel very fortunate to end up here.
Nice. If I do find myself down there, I will be reaching out. If you're up here in NorCal, let me know.
Absolutely. We'd love, if you're ever down here, love to take you out for dinner or grab a drink or something and just shoot the breeze. But this has just been tremendous. Again, for me, a lot to think about and reflect on. I just really appreciate your insight and your willingness to share your heart and your story with us, and Brittany's story and how she was such an advocate and just what she did, and the courage that she exemplified for people is tremendous. So thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. And sending, I don't know the specifics, but all the shit that you're having to navigate, and with cancer and all that, it's something that it's just crazy at times, that it's just a swirling chaos. At other times, there's moments where you can focus on the happiness and of just life and everything. But through the cosmic universe sending all in positive energy and all of that your way. This is one of those where when people say, words fail, people would come, like I don't ever say that whole, if there's anything I can do. Brittany ended up with a pretty snarky answer. She's like, you want to help? See if you can come up with a cure for a brain tumor. To the point, and it's coming from a good place. Like they just feel so helpless. So they feel like, I got to offer something. There's ever anything I can do for you?
Yeah.
And that got to be her response. We're like, we can't say that. It's not going to come across well.
Sure.
It people's reaction to her whenever she would share. Actually, for her, she would just take her hair and flip it the other way, and you would see that, the big ass scar from the tumor. And they'd be just like, holy shit, what is that? So, I get it, but I recognize now sometimes the best words that I could come up with when I've talked with people is just this, it's just the acknowledgement of saying there's days it's just shit. It's like,
totally.
That's what it is.
Yep.
Now, hopefully,
you're right.
You try as best you can to make today a good day, and tomorrow, and string a few together, and you're like, I had a good week, and see if you could do that for a couple weeks, and there'll be ups and downs, but that's all we ended up doing with Brittany. It's like, how can we make today the best we possibly can? And hopefully at the end of the day, when we're laying our heads down to sleep on those pillows, that we can kind of smile and say, we were somewhat successful. Today was a pretty good day. We were able to go outside or do whatever, was on the agenda. Other days, you just hunker down and watch something on television. But I wishing you some of those positive and good days.
Thanks, Dan. That means a lot. And I'm a believer in, you kind of referred to the universe and that cosmic, I guess, entity. Energy entity. And I'm a big believer in that stuff. And I believe that the universe brought us together to have this discussion. And, you know, I'll keep holding on to that and definitely be learning from this discussion. So I just really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Andrew.
We'll be in touch. Maybe we'll send you an email down the line and just, you know, drop a line and say hi. But until then, take care of yourself. And thank you again for being such an advocate.
Absolutely. Thanks, Andrew.
All right.
Thank you.
See you, Dan. Bye.
All right. Take care.